In our continuing series on the three religions, I'm once again with Rabbi Raphael Kaiserbluth, and I'm going to call him Rabbi Rafi for now, because it's so much easier to say. And we're going to talk today about the festivals, the Jewish festivals, which run throughout the year, as far as I can understand.
Yes, they do.
Where do you start?
I suppose the best place to start is at the New Year, which would be usually in the autumn, September. This year, it's going to be actually in October. Just as a quick word, the Jewish calendar's slight quirkiness is that it's a hybrid lunar-solar calendar. It is based on the lunar calendar, but the holidays need to match up with the right season. And so every so often, including this year, is a leap year. Now, it's not like the Gregorian leap year where they add every 4 years one day, which, February 29th. The Hebrew leap year is that we add an entire month. And it's not every 4 years. There's a cycle of 19 years where they add sometimes or they don't add sometimes. And so that way it keeps the festivals in the right season. And so you could say that Rosh Hashanah, the new year, is arriving late. It's actually not. It's arriving right on time. It just happens to be that the Gregorian calendar doesn't quite match up with it as it normally does. But
argue about calendars. What can we argue about?
Yeah, exactly. So the first place, I suppose, would be to start in Rosh Hashanah, the new year, which literally means Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year or the new year. And that is at the beginning of the calendar year, although even that is slightly up for interpretation because the Jewish calendar has not one, not two, not three, but four new years. There is the new year that commemorates the creation of the world. There is the new year in the springtime, which commemorates the birthday of the trees. And then later on, the birthday of the independence of the Israelites when they left Egypt. And then there's also the birthday for the animals that were used during sacrifices. So there are four new years.
Now, are these four new years celebrated by all Jews?
Most Jews would probably have no idea about the last one. They will know about the birthday of the trees. It's a relatively minor festival, and they might know about the new year celebrating the creation of the Jewish nation, but it's not Passover. It's just a little bit before Passover. But most people, if you ask Jews, they'll say New Year is Rosh Hashanah.
Which again, you said, is it celebrating the
creation of the world. Okay. And it's a two-day festival, and it is the beginning of a high holiday period, which is 10 days. And the end of it is a Day of Atonement, which we'll get to very shortly. But Rosh Hashanah is the beginning of this period of judgment. It's also called Yom Hadin, the Day of Judgment. It's also called Yom Teruah, the Day of the Shofar, the blast of the horn. And it is this idea that we are, yes, commemorating the creation of the world, but we are also beginning this period of introspection where we are, in essence, being judged for our actions the previous year. And there are many different rituals associated with it, the idea of life and sweetness. And so we have things like apples dipped in honey, apple signifying the rebirth, fruit and honey being the sweetness. There's some customs that eat, instead of the normal plaited bread that we call a challah, it's a round one. Again, the circular notion of the year.
And is this food in the home?
This is food in the home. Almost all of our holidays, even the fast days, you'll notice that there's a common theme, and that's food. And the idea is, what I tell people is, what we do in the synagogue is very nice. It's very beautiful. And what we do in the schools is also very nice and beautiful. But if it doesn't happen at home, that really is the essence, the center of Jewish life is the home. And so meals are really centerpieces of rituals for all of these holidays. So the liturgy on Rosh Hashanah is quite extended, quite a bit longer. There's also this custom of casting our sins into the stream that's taken from a line from the prophet Malachi, where, again, a physical representation of what we're trying to do, rid ourselves of these things that are weighing us down. And
a lot of people take the new year as an opportunity to have a new attempt at getting fit or to stop eating.
Correct. There is the same kind of idea that it is a renewal, if you will, a rebirth of yourself, that you're entering into this period where it's not always forward looking. It's looking back. Where have I not lived up to my expectations? Where could I have done better? And part of the things leading up to it is this idea of asking forgiveness. We come to God to ask for forgiveness, but if you recall from our previous conversation, that there is that triple relationship you have with yourself, with your fellow human, and with God. it is inappropriate or not possible for me to go to ask forgiveness to God until I have asked forgiveness from those who I may have offended. And there is, you'll see around that time of year, many Jews will be asking forgiveness for sins that they may or may not have done. And we see that in the way the Ten Commandments are structured, that one side deals with relationships with God, right? I am the Lord your God, don't worship any other gods, don't swear falsely, observe the Sabbath. The one on the other side are those with relationship between me and my fellow human. And so it is exemplifying that by asking forgiveness first from you before I can go to God. And that the Rosh Hashanah, the new year, begins that process that will last for 10 days. Now, the rabbis are very, very clear to tell us, our tradition, that it's not only during those 10 days that you're supposed to be acting and asking for forgiveness. It's a process throughout the year. It's just this time of year, it's a very special focus.
Okay. And do you do that in the synagogue and in the house?
So in the house. So
arguments between husband and wife will be resolved.
That's the idea, hopefully. And again, not just during that time period, but throughout the rest of the year. But there is this idea of heightened spirituality. There is this idea of recalling the creation, and a lot of the metaphors are that God is our shepherd in that time period, but a lot of ideas of morality, because there was a time and a place in our history where people literally believed that our lives were being judged, and it hung in the balance. And so one of the common themes is that God is inscribing us into the book of life. That's what we keep praying for. Please inscribe us in the book of life. And our liturgy on our daily basis, even during the regular week after the holiday, before the Day of Atonement, changes to exemplify, please write us in the book of life. And so it's a two-day festival, and it's one of the high holidays that Jews who don't necessarily come during the rest of the year will come on these 3 days, much like practitioners of other faiths will come on those specific high holidays, like Christians will come.
Does high holiday a translation of something specific?
No, that's the anglicized translation. Really, we call it Yamim Noraim, the days of fear or awe. The days of awe. Okay. And it is those 10 days of heightened awareness and heightened spirituality. And because again, people literally believe their life hung in the balance. Okay. Now, that culminates in the Day of Atonement, which is 10 days after Rosh Hashanah. And that is a full day of spiritual enlightenment. Now, many people see this as a day of sadness, but it's actually not. It's a day that hopefully we prepared ourselves to such a degree of holiness and spirituality, we have separated ourselves from our physical needs. Now, in general, Judaism is not an ascetic religion. We do not condone or promote denying of physical needs in any way. Even in the Bible, when it talks about the Nazarite, for example, it is not something that's promoted, and it says even if they do that, then they need to give a sin offering.
Nazarites being what?
Ones who would not consume alcohol, ones who would not cut their hair, who would really, in a very crude way, they're Jewish monks. But they're only allowed to do it for a very brief period, a set period of time. And it's just showing that we don't promote that kind of a relationship. That's not what we're looking for. Okay. Judaism does embrace the needs of the physical, whether it be food or drink or relations with our spouses. But on this day, we refrain. We refrain from five basic things: food, drink, bathing, anointing, comfortable shoes, and intimate relations. Because we do not need those physical things. We have elevated ourselves to such a spiritual plane, hopefully, that those things are not needed. And the idea on that day, we are praying for the atonement, that now we have cleansed ourselves, and we are asking now God to forgive our sins. And there, in the biblical times, in the times of the temple, there was a very intricate involved ritual where the high priest would enter into the inner sanctum of the temple and perform rituals three times for himself, for his tribe, and for the Jewish people to rid them of all of these sins. And what you'd like to do is you're entering a phase. So you're going from one phase to the next. This past year to the next, you want to go in with as clean a slate as possible. So traditionally, Jews wore white. There's a robe that they wear, which is reminiscent of the robes that they will be clothed in when they die. It's also, by the way, what color do you wear generally during a wedding? White. Now, many people may chuckle, but I tell them there's quite a tremendous relationship between the Day of Atonement, death, and marriage. And many people only hear wedding and death is, you know, aside from the obvious jokes, but the idea is laying out that you are transitioning from one phase of your life to the next, and you would like to go in with as clean a slate as possible. So when you die, obviously you're not eating. On Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, you're not eating. And there's a Jewish tradition on the day of your wedding, you fast as well. You wear white after you pass away. You wear white on Yom Kippur, and you wear white on your day of marriage. When you die, there is a ritual immersion or a bath, if you will, that you are bathed after you pass away. Many Jews will go to the ritual immersion before Yom Kippur, and many Jews, before they get married, will ritually immerse themselves. And those rituals are there for the same reason. You are moving from one phase of your life to the next, death from this world to the next, Yom Kippur from last year to this year, and marriage from your single life to your married life. And each of them, you are trying to move and have a clean slate. And so it is a longer service. You are there most of the day, and you finish with an extra service that is only done in the evening on the Day of Atonement. It's not done in any other time of year. And the metaphor many times on Yom Kippur is that of the gates are closing. We've opened them up earlier on the week before, 10 days before the Rosh Hashanah. Yom Kippur, the gates are beginning to close, that it is our final time to have God. At this point, the liturgy changes to not inscribe us in the Book of Life, but to seal us in the Book of Life. And it finishes, and the tradition is that at the end, it's a great celebration because we've made it now, and we're still alive. Therefore, we have been sealed in the Book of Life, and we have another year to live. And this is followed a few days later by the holiday of Sukkot, which is translated sometimes as Tabernacles. And it is reminiscent. We build a hut, and it is reminiscent of the times when we were wandering in the desert, living in a hut.
Do you build a hut in the house?
Well, not in the house, but outside the house. In the garden, correct. And the idea is you are to dwell in that for those seven, 8 days. It's a little bit more difficult here in England because usually the weather at that time of year, or all throughout the year, is rain and not very warm. Now, if you're living in Israel, or where I grew up in Los Angeles, it's a lot easier to do that sort of thing. So it is, again, it's not just reminiscent of wandering in the desert, but it's also you have just finished this incredible spiritual moment where you have separated yourself from your physical needs, and you are supposed to look at what is actually important in your life. Okay. The physical needs, you have already gone and a whole day without needing them, which is not to say, again, that your house is not important, but maybe, perhaps, not to take it for granted. To move out of your home for 6, 7, or 7, 8 days and not have the sturdiness of four walls, bricks and mortars, but, you know, canvas. What is really important in your life? What do you actually need versus what do you want? And that's one of the messages of that holiday. It's an agricultural festival, one of the three main festivals, and probably in historic times, Sukkot was the most important holiday. It was sometimes called Ha-Chag, literally the holiday. That's what it was known as. And you can see the importance of it based on the list of the sacrifices that it had in the Bible, which was way above and beyond any other festival. Nowadays, it's been diminished quite a bit in importance, and Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur have taken prominence. It's just the way things have developed, but it is, it's a festival, and it's one of the three pilgrimage festivals, Passover and Shavuot being the other two, that traditionally people would make a pilgrimage from wherever they were in the land of Israel to Jerusalem to celebrate.
So when does this next year in Jerusalem phrase come up? That is that at...
That is said various different times at the end of Yom Kippur, but it is this idea that our aim is to be in Jerusalem.
Is that a real or an image?
It's an image. It's an idea that because we will be in Jerusalem because the Messiah has come and brought us all back to Israel, and we'll be celebrating. It's a beautiful idea. Right. I'm not sure Jerusalem could cope with whatever 15 million Jews in the world all at once. They could barely cope with what they have there. So,
okay. You mentioned Passover, and that must be one of the main festivals as well.
That is one of the second of the pilgrimage festivals. There's a few in between, but Passover is probably the most important family holiday because of the first two nights where we have a Seder. In essence, it's a giant meal, and its focus is the children. You're telling the story, and the commandment that we're supposed to do is tell the story as if you yourself were there leaving Egypt. And now, Passover is a foundational moment in our history because it's the first time that we are a people, a nation, rather than a bunch of individuals.
Because at that stage,
they had left Egypt and while in, they came down to the house of Jacob, 70 people, they leave Egypt as a people. It's that foundational identity that's created at that moment, and we need to tell our children. So there's rules about you're supposed to start early enough so children can be a part of it, and there are mnemonics. And
This is part of the meal.
And the Seder literally means order. That's what it means, and there's a specific order of things that you do, and it takes the form of a Roman... symposium. It's supposed to be asking questions.
Why is this giving day answers, so different?
Why exactly the four questions? Why is this night different from all other nights? You'll see many Jews who do really nothing else during the year. They will, the vast majority of Jews will do something for Passover. Will do something. Whether it's the full service or not, they will get together with family and have a Passover meal. And what we're supposed to do also is remove leavened products from our house and eat unleavened bread and other unleavened products for those 8 days. And so there's two of these meals, the Seder night, and we have to finish by a certain time also because the children, again, need to be involved. This is an educational process for them where we are trying to tell them our story of who we are. And so throughout the course of the evening, there are games in part of the, like you hide a piece of the matzah, the unleavened bread that they have to find at the dessert to keep them awake, to keep them engaged. There are songs that are sung at the end, again, for the same reason, to keep them engaged, to keep them awake. And it is a beautiful intergenerational moment that is part of our tradition. It's part of the ritual. This is what we do. This is how we teach. It is not just about a meal. It's about the message of the meal.
Just go back to the origins of Passover. Actually, the death passed over the Israelites.
That is where the name comes from. That the angel of death or the messenger of God or God.
This is the time of the plagues in Egypt.
The 10th plague where the death of the firstborn, and it passed over the homes of the
Israelites.
Because
each house had been marked in blood.
Exactly.
And there is an ongoing, you have a symbol outside your house.
That has nothing to do actually with this. That is something different that we have, what's called a mezuzah, but has nothing to do with this.
Okay, so we're going to run out of time, and we've got a lot of festivals.
Yes, we have a calendar chock full of stuff.
We've done Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur,
and Passover.
Pesach. What else? Purim is
a little before. I could jump to Shavuot first, which is linked inextricably with Passover, because that's the moment where that's the third pilgrimage festival, which commemorates the giving of the Torah, the commandments, the covenant, even at Mount Sinai. That's 7 weeks after leaving Egypt. Now, it's unique in the calendar in that the Bible doesn't tell us what day it is. It only tells us it's 7 weeks after Passover, commemorating the 7 weeks from crossing the Red Sea to arriving at Mount Sinai. And that is, if you've ever seen the movie Prince of Egypt, its story finishes not with the crossing of the Red Sea, which most people associate with the end of the Exodus story. It's actually the arrival and the giving of the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai. We are freed at Egypt, but without a purpose, without an aim, without anything unifying us. And the end, the coda of that story is this, the reception of the covenant, the entering into the covenant, the purpose given to us as a free people. And therefore, they're inextricably linked. Passover and Shavuot, 7 weeks apart, counting every night. There's a ritual that you count every night from the second night of Passover until Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks, some people call it, or Pentecost. That is that main festival. Purim is a month before Passover, is commemorating the story of Esther in Persia, and we read the book of Esther. And what's unique about that book is God is not mentioned once in that entire book. It's also a very kid-friendly holiday. We read the story, and every time the baddie, Haman, is named, we make a lot of noise. It gets very ruckus, very rowdy. Kinds of behavior you wouldn't necessarily associate with a place of worship, but it is people come in fancy dress. We read the story, and we make lots of noise.
What's the point of
this point of this story is one of these times where you could look at some of our Jewish holidays, or many of them, and sum it up briefly as, they tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. It goes for a lot of the Jewish holidays, but this one specifically is this time of deliverance, redemption, that the odds were against us. And the message here, the rabbis teach, why did they include this festival and the book of Esther, that does not include God's name at all, is that even in our day and age, and this is a relatively modern festival, even in our day and age, God still acts in our lives, maybe subtle, but you need to be open to the possibility that God is still there. It reminds me of a quote from Albert Einstein. Coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous in our lives. That there's these things that happen, that Esther happened to be picked as the queen and happened to be there at just the right time when Haman tried to exterminate all the Jews, and she was able to make a change. You could chalk that up to coincidence. I choose not to. I choose to believe that there's a purpose, and it was meant to be. It was meant to be. And so that's why that's one of the holidays that's included in our calendar.
Well, thanks very much. We can't cover all of them because you have so many holidays during the year.
You should come and join us for some of them. I think you'd enjoy it.
Okay. We've got more to go. Thanks very much.
Well, Rob, it's a pleasure.